You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of November 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Victoria Graham.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll set the day's news agenda with Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Ben, what do you have for us today?
Ukraine stuns Europe by choosing Russia over the association agreement. Georgia seeks detente with the Kremlin and Netanyahu in Moscow lobbying on Iran.
Bit of a Russian foreign policy special then, coming up from Ben later. Also ahead on today's programme. It's been almost 2 months since Germans went to the ballot box, but the country still has no government. We'll get the latest on the coalition talks in Berlin.
Also coming up, we'll check in with one of our correspondents around the world and leaf through the day's front pages. And before the end of the programme, we conclude our series on soft power around the world to coincide with Monocle's 2013 Soft Power Survey. Today we ask how cycling in Bogota made Colombia a soft power player.
Their aim now is to really have a Colombian team made up of 100% Colombian riders compete and win in Europe.
All that, plus we spin some fantastic music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, at 1 minute past eight here in London, let's catch up on the world headlines from Paul Osborne.
Ukraine has suspended preparations for a trade deal with the European Union days before a summit on the issue. It came hours after MPs rejected a bill that would have allowed the jailed opposition leader Yulia Tymoshenko to leave the country, a condition demanded by the EU if the deal was to proceed. Ukraine has faced intense pressure from Russia not to sign the trade pact, and Ukraine says it has scrapped the talks to protect national security. Maya Kochanich is a spokeswoman for the European Commission.
We will have the Eastern Partnership Summit in a week's time in Vilnius. There are still concrete deliverables that we hope to achieve at this summit, but obviously we were also very much hoping to have this signature, which, as I said, now is not going to happen.
12 people are now known to have died when the roof of a supermarket collapsed in Riga, the capital of Latvia. Three of the victims were emergency workers who were helping people trapped in the rubble when another section of the roof collapsed. Dozens of other people are thought to be missing. A criminal investigation has started. International talks on Iran's nuclear program are resuming in Geneva, but representatives of both Iran and world powers say a significant number of issues remain unresolved. Iran is being offered limited sanctions relief in return for agreeing to curtail uranium enrichment work. But leaders in the US Senate have said they'll impose new sanctions within weeks if there's no deal. A charity says three women allegedly held in a house in London as slaves for 30 years have been kept in horrific conditions. A married couple who were arrested by police over the women's detention have been released on bail. Police say that all three women are highly traumatized. Anita Prem is the founder of the Freedom Charity, which was contacted by one of the women earlier this year.
In an ordinary house, in an ordinary street, the busiest in our capital city. So it's quite shocking, really, that this can go on. I think we all feel very humbled that we've been able to assist in something so miraculous that's we've never heard of happening in this country before, and it's been very overwhelming, but we're really relieved they're in a place of safety and slowly they'll be able to rebuild their lives.
There have been further demonstrations in Indonesia's capital, Jakarta, after revelations the country's government was targeted in an Australian spying operation. Indonesia's president has halted military and other diplomatic cooperation with Australia, demanding an explanation of the surveillance. Nepal's Maoist leader has said he doesn't accept the results of an election that his party appears to be losing. Six governments have collapsed in the 7 years since Maoist fighters laid down their weapons after a lengthy civil war. After alleging ballot rigging, Maoist leaders have demanded that officials stop counting the votes which were cast in Tuesday's election. Eva Jolly, who's the EU's chief election monitor in Nepal, says objections must be raised formally.
If some political parties are not satisfied with this process, if they have allegations, they must, as every citizen, come up with the evidence of what they are saying. And they must use the legal ways.
Today is the final day of global talks on climate change in Poland, but environmental campaigners at the negotiations say they've become a mockery. Around 800 walked out of the talks yesterday, saying there's little evidence of any commitment to agree a binding deal to cut greenhouse gas emissions. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you to Paul Osborne. It's 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House on Monocle 24. We're live from Studio One in London, where it's 8.06, 12.06 in Moscow. Time to set the day's news agenda. And joining us today is Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Ben, welcome back to the programme. I know you're just back from Siberia. It's great to see you. And you've got a bit of a Russian foreign policy special for us this morning. Perhaps we should be talking about how the Ukraine is falling in and out of Russia.
Well, today
out
is
of love with Russia.
Well, and today is a great day for Vladimir Putin. Quick on the heels of his triumph in Syria, which a country he believes he saved from a Western invasion. The stunning news yesterday that Ukraine has abandoned talks and abandoned plans to sign what's called the Association Agreement with the EU. That's the first step towards eventually joining the Union, in which a country resets its trade preferences away from other blocs, i.e. Russia, towards Europe. The Ukrainian government issued a statement yesterday saying for reasons of national security, it was abandoning plans to deepen ties to the EU in favour of Russia. Putin views this as a masterstroke, saving Ukraine, a country he doesn't consider a truly independent, a country that he believes will soon be reintegrated into Russia. He views this as perhaps one of his finest achievements in foreign policy in the past 10 years.
So what are these reasons of national security then?
Putin promised economic war if Ukraine chose Europe. He said that Ukraine, which does most of its trade with Russia, Ukrainians would need visas to travel to Russia. There would be blocks on the border. All Ukrainian products would be banned from entering the Russian market. There would be trade embargoes.
Blackmail by any other name?
The European leaders have said these are the politics of brutal pressure. What the main reason that Ukraine decided to abandoned plans for the EU deal is the cumulative cost of this blackmail would have been roughly a quarter to a third of Ukrainian GDP. With elections just a year from now, in which Ukraine's kleptocratic leader, Mr. Yanukovych, would be facing re-election, such a recession in the run-up to that simply would have destroyed that regime, and they viewed it as not being worth it. Ukraine asked the EU if it would be willing to pay for the losses that would have been incurred, and the Europeans were not prepared. Often I get the impression that with Ukrainian politics, the EU doesn't realise what a game of high stakes this is for Moscow. You know, Ukraine to Russia, it's not Austria to Germany, it's Bavaria to Germany. The independence of Ukraine has not been accepted by the Russian population. And underlying all of these ideas, Putin's customs union with Belarus and Kazakhstan, the CSTO military alliance with Central Asian states and post-Soviet states, is the assumption that Ukraine will be back. Like, for the Russian elite, large amounts of them are born in Ukraine. If you would go through the Russian cabinet or the senior Kremlin staff, you'll find that a good third of these people would have grown up in Ukraine, which until 1991, unlike Georgia or unlike Central Asia, really was the same place in their imagination.
I mean, the EU certainly are not very happy about this move, are they?
European leaders are stunned. It was believed until the very last minute that Ukraine would not bow in to to Russia would try and make an affirmation of its independence, that Ukraine would choose the long-term prosperity of Europe over the short-term losses that Russia could inflict. I get the impression that there's, from speaking to some diplomats and EU experts yesterday, that there's already a question of, like, who lost Ukraine. That in the run-up to the EU's Vilnius summit, which was supposed to be a historic summit in which Ukraine took a decisive move towards Europe, the EU's project, the Eastern Partnership, which is a series of trade and visa deals that were supposed to tie in post-Soviet countries excluding Russia into the Union, this Eastern Partnership is in flames.
Ben, to what extent are people looking at Georgia and seeing the fallout there from their tearing away from Russia and saying we don't want that?
The winners out of Ukraine's loss are likely to be Moldova and Georgia, and EU leaders will be willing to give these countries far more flack and far less flack, and will give them far better deals on visas and trade preferences.
And yet Georgia's new premier is saying that he will stick to the pro-Western course, but he wants to seek a thaw with relations with Russia.
Another success for Putin in foreign policy. Georgia's new premier, Iraki Garibashvili, who's taken over from the oligarch Benzina Ivanishvili, who entered politics dramatically last year, spent a vast amount of his fortune to depose Mikhail Saakashvili, who fought a brief war with Russia in 2008, and is now retired from politics, letting Mr. Garibashvili take over. He has said that his new government will seek to overcome a crisis in relations with Russia. This is pretty dramatic because under Saakashvili, Georgia was the crusader of the former Soviet states. An ally of Congress, the favourite state of John McCain, spreading its own vision of anti-corruption and revolution and ties to Europe, seeking to join NATO across the post-Soviet world. And now to see a Georgian government in many ways meekly accepting the loss of half of its territory in Abkhazia and South Ossetia, trying to seek a detente with Moscow that's essentially given nothing, shows that perhaps Russia was right in its vision not to cave in to European and American pressure to release territories, to kind of move to downscale its presence in Georgia, and that Putin was correct, that Russia should stick to its position, and sooner or later the West would lose interest and Georgia would cave.
But Georgia does need to open up. It needs to expand, doesn't it?
Again, it's EU leaders had the assumption that Georgia's trade was reorientating towards Europe, and that it's the EU's vastly superior market could compensate for losses in Russia. However, what EU leaders overlooked is that maybe 20% to 25% of ethnic Georgians in the world actually live in Russia, and the huge historic demographic ties are a vast amount of Georgia's trade, and that Georgia's main trade market has historically been Russia. In the Soviet Union, Georgia was cast as the wine-producing country, and to this day, Russians' wine of choice is Georgian wine. And the destruction of that market by Putin, who illegalized Georgian wine in Russia, was a huge blow to Georgian peasants and Georgian farmers, whose disgruntlement is one of the reasons that Saakashvili lost power.
Let's move over to a different kind of disgruntlement altogether, that of Benjamin Netanyahu's with the US and co, who seem to be moving ever closer to a deal with Iran. He's going to Russia to lobby against Iran. This looks like somewhat desperate measures, does it not, given that Russia, along with China, were the ones until very recently who were not up for imposing tougher sanctions on Iran. What leverage can they possibly have now?
As one of the most surprising features of world politics this year has been the surprising decline of the Obama presidency, for a whole series of events, from the Snowden affair to the botched Syria campaign to the shutdown to the Obamacare scandals. The power of this presidency has been declining rapidly. And into this void, Putin has been seeking to restore Russian influence in the Middle East. Putin believes that he has saved Syria from intervention. And one of the long-term goals of Russian foreign policy has been to save Iran from bombing and to save Iran from war. It's worth saying that the people building the Iranian nuclear reactors are not Iranians but Russians, and that the Bushehr reactor is staffed by several hundred Russian technicians, and preserving this huge multi-billion dollar deal and a soft alliance with Tehran has been a Russian foreign policy priority. So Putin views the fact that the West is moving somewhat desperately towards a pact with Iran over nuclear enrichment as another sign that the Bush era of Russia being pushed up against the wall is over and that Russia's now on the offensive in the Middle East. Seems that Israel agrees. Benjamin Netanyahu was just in Moscow, and Israel is behind the scenes trying to lobby Russia for influence over Iran, as it feels the US is no longer listening to it and moving for reasons of Obama's domestic popularity towards a bad deal with Iran. It's worth noting that Israel's foreign minister Avigdor Lieberman, who's just been restored to the post of foreign minister, was born in the Soviet Union and is more comfortable in Russian than he is in Hebrew. And he will be visiting Moscow shortly to continue these debates and attempts to persuade Moscow to change its mind.
Well, one wonders if Netanyahu will ever be happy, if there ever be a deal that he'll be happy with. But Ben, thank you very much indeed. That was Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin.
Coming up, almost 2 months since going to the polls, Germans still don't have a government. We'll unpick Germany's political limbo right after this.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time, it was seen with disdain, but over the years, that culture had gotten so popular, it's iconic now.
If you're serving decent food in East London, I don't think you've got any problem getting custom in. And I worked in the West End for years, you know. I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu. Every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Well, they say a week is a long time in politics, so 8 without a clear picture on who's going to run a country must seem like a lifetime, especially in post-war Germany, which is not exactly used to such a state of affairs. But now more talks are underway in the country, which could pave the way for a grand coalition, or could it? Following rejection from the Greens, Angela Merkel's Conservatives and the centre-left Social Democrats have finally entered into negotiations, but not without concessions.
Negotiations aside, SDP members are keen not to repeat history. Their last coalition with the Conservatives cost some considerable support, so this time the stakes are really quite high. So will a deal be done which would give Angela Merkel her third term in office? Well, joining us now to discuss this further is Andreas Kluth, Berlin Bureau Chief for The Economist. Welcome to the show, Andreas. Can you just outline for us what are the SDP demanding, and are these demands negotiable or not?
The Social Democrats are demanding, above all, basically a whole laundry list of pretty much standard leftist demands, and the topping it is a demand for a minimum wage, which Germany, unlike the UK and many other countries, does not have, of €8.50. I think that's about $11. I'm not sure what it would be in pounds. It's quite high, and it's against the tradition by which wages have been set in Germany quite successfully for the whole post-war period. So that's their top demand. Then they have some others. They want dual citizenship, where there were some changes about 13 years ago to make that more complicated for especially people with Turkish parents. They want quotas for women on corporate boards. And then, as I said, they want, they agree, both sides, on higher pensions for a lot of groups of people, and even a lower pension age. After raising the pension age in the last grand coalition to 67, they want to lower it again for a lot of people. So these are all, you would say, in the spectrum here in Germany, these are traditional leftist demands. They don't have much to do with the large topics, the European Union, the euro crisis, the energy transition. It's more of this is fodder for their base. the social democratic base.
Andreas, is there any sense that Merkel and her party would actually prefer new elections to having to capitulate on some of those concessions?
No, I mean, I'll tell you how new elections could happen. I'm not saying it's likely, but it's a distinct possibility for the... That would be the first time in post-war German history. That would be... By the way, it would be really, really dramatic and spectacular because it would be the first time you'd have a full-blown political crisis without any economic or social crisis underlying it. In other words, there's no reason for this, really, objectively. But the way it could happen is... Sigmar Gabriel is the leader of the Social Democrats, and in order to stay in power and to bring his base along, he said, well, we're going to negotiate with Angela Merkel now and her Bavarian sidekicks, and we're going to do a contract, and that contract will happen probably next week already, by the way. But then we're going to let you guys, the members of the Social Democratic Party, it's about 470 thousand. So not the delegates, but the members. We're going to let you vote in a mail-in referendum. And that's going to happen in early December, and it will be counted in December 14th. And that's, shall we say, the base of this party is traditional blue-collar voters. They're not necessarily reading the news or the foreign news. They're not necessarily interested in Germany's role in Europe and so forth. And they may say no, because as you said in your intro, they don't have good memories of the last time they had a coalition with Ms. Merkel. So then Mrs. Merkel will have been turned down by both of the center-left parties. There's only one party left in the parliament now. That's the far-left, ex-communist left party. It's called the Left. That's out of the question. So then she could try a minority government, but that's considered unstable. That would probably then lead to new elections. In that case, and then, of course, we might get the same result again. I mean, the polls show we would do the same again today. And in that case, we could be here until Easter during this.
Do you think this lack of government, this indecision, is harming Germany in the long run?
Two things are, well, yes, it is harming Europe especially. There are some actually large challenges facing Germany and Europe. As you know, there's the euro crisis in Europe. In Germany, but that's also a European topic, there's this very problematic transition to renewable energies, which is a lot of people say is going wrong. That needs to be reformed. And then there's a demographic time bomb ticking all along that we've always known about it. They're not tackling these three big issues. So by delaying, Europe and Germany is leaderless or rudderless. It's just drifting right now. Okay, if they managed to pull it along, then it was just a 2-3 month delay. That's no big deal. But then, and this is the other problem, is then it looks at the moment like this particular grand coalition will do it with a program in order to make it happen at all, with a program that is very mediocre and possibly even disastrous. I mean, they're backtracking on a lot of the successful reforms that the last social democratic chancellor enacted a decade ago, which made Germany so strong now. They want to reverse, the social democrats themselves want to reverse their own former reforms because they feel they've gone too far, but that could jeopardize Germany's strength. And if you jeopardize Germany's strength, you're actually jeopardizing all of Europe.
But clearly, as you say, there's a loud chorus of voices putting pressure on Merkel in terms of, you know, leaders of labor unions, pension and healthcare administrators, big car makers, employer organizations, the prestigious economic panel, the German Council of Economic Experts, all criticizing some of these reform plans, all putting pressure on Merkel. How is she herself weathering this 8-week storm that she's found herself in?
Thank you for teeing me up, because this is something I've been saying to all, including my editors, all the Anglo-Saxon, the American and British commentators, is you make them, from outside Germany, it looks like there is a sort of a queen named Angela Merkel running this place. That's not really what the truth is. So you just said Angela Merkel is being given this advice. Yes, she knows all of that already. She knows every detail of this, I promise you. That's not the point. She has to form a coalition at the moment of three parties, by the way. Her Bavarian sidekicks are their own party with their own agenda. She has to keep those on board. The Social Democrats, I just told you how with that referendum, they've essentially boxed her in. So she needs to pass that SPD referendum as well. Otherwise, there's no deal. So it's not that she doesn't understand why a minimum wage at this rate in East and West Germany could be bad. She understands that. But she has no choice. The alternative is no coalition at all, and then, as I said to you again, maybe new elections and being here until Easter. So Mrs. Merkel understands all of this, but Mrs. Merkel is just one small part of this chaotic, you know, in a piece I've written recently, I compared to a steamy kitchen, and there's lots of cooks, and she's sort of like at the door greeting the patrons coming in, and she holds the cooks together so that nothing explodes in an oven and stuff. But all these cooks are cooking, and they want to be acknowledged, and they're putting their spices in there, and that's how it happens in Germany. So Angela Merkel is mainly presiding over this, and by the way, in the last couple of weeks, the last month basically, more or less since the election, she's almost not doing public speaking at all. It's mainly the Social Democrats and Bavarian conservatives that are speaking out loud, because they're talking through the media to their own base so that their own base accepts this. Mrs. Merkel is just standing back, letting them, you know, sow their oats to blow off the steam, because she knows she needs them. So she would have preferred to do something else entirely with a different party that's been kicked out. So it's not really her, you know, not understanding that some of these things are dangerous. It's her trying to, if anything, water it down to make them less toxic. But she's going to have to do a lot of this.
Andreas, the saga continues. That was Andreas Klute. Thank you very much indeed. Berlin Bureau Chief for The Economist.
It's 6:26 in Sao Paulo, 8:26 in London, 15:26 in Shanghai. And that's where we're heading now to check in with our correspondent there, Justin Bergman. Good afternoon, Justin. Thank you very much for joining us today. Let's start, shall we, with this huge news out of China recently that it's relaxing within limits, its one-child policy. But now an announcement that birth rates could still fall. Tell us more.
This is big news in China over the past week. The announcement that was made last Friday, actually, that the one-child policy would be relaxed to allow couples who have at least one person, one member of the couple being an only child, that couple will be allowed to have two children in the future or more. Right now, currently, both parents need to be only children in order to qualify for the second child. So this has been, you know, a much detested policy that has been in effect for 30 years. And what's not entirely surprising is that, results from polls are showing that Chinese people, especially the ones living in big cities, aren't necessarily wanting to have second children now that they've grown, now that they're working more and that they're growing richer and they have more pressures in their lives, and having second children actually, you know, does cost a lot more in China these days.
Let's move on to your second topic, because we are running out of time today, sadly. But the U.S. Ambassador Gary Locke is leaving China. Is this a bit of a shock?
Yes. Well, he's been in the post for about 2.5 years, so it's not entirely shocking. But what has been kind of amusing this week has been the reaction of Chinese people online, joking that he has been pushed out of China because of the pollution in Beijing being so bad. He actually responded to this in an interview with the LA Times, saying that this is definitely not the reason he's leaving, but he is concerned about the pollution. That's obvious. He's been seen as being actually one of the, you know, working well with the Chinese leaders here, as opposed to his predecessor, John Huntsman, who had a pretty hard time with the leadership in China. So to see Gary Locke go, it's going to be kind of sad for his fans in China. He did make quite a splash when he came to the post a couple years ago for his supposed common touch, and this was because he was shown in photographs buying his own coffee at Starbucks and carrying his own bag at the airport.
Many shock horror.
Shocked that their own leaders would never do such a thing.
Of course, he was the first Chinese-American ambassador as well, so that's significant in itself. Let's move over very quickly, Justin, to another story. A Chinese hero buying luxury homes for an entire village. Tell us more.
Yeah. Well, this is a rags-to-riches story that's been making waves in the domestic press. A man named Tang Gua, who left his hometown in Sichuan province with 2 renminbi in his pocket, later became head of a real estate construction group, and instead of taking all of his riches and stashing it overseas or buying luxury cars, he's actually buying every person in his village a new house. So they've started construction. There's going to be 70 new luxury villas built in his old village, and obviously a lot of people online saying that this is an example that, many rich Chinese tycoons could learn from.
Indeed. Thank you very much indeed, Justin Bergman in Shanghai. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll meet the author Joseph Boyden, whose latest novel takes a sweeping look at the plight of Canada's Indigenous peoples. And we'll bring you the fifth and final part of our Soft Power series. Today, we're bicycling in Bogota.
Their aim now is to really have a Colombian team made up of 100% Colombian riders compete and win in Europe.
But first, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
21 people are now known to have died after the roof of a supermarket collapsed in the capital of Latvia, Riga. Three of the victims were emergency workers who were helping people trapped in the rubble when another section of the roof collapsed. It's thought a number of others are still missing. Ukraine has suspended preparations for a trade deal with the European Union just days before a summit on the issue is due to be held. It came hours after MPs rejected a bill that would have allowed the jailed opposition leader Yulia Tymoshenko to leave the country, a condition which had been demanded by the EU. Ukraine had faced intense pressure from Russia not to sign the trade pact and says it scrapped the talks to protect national security. International negotiations on Iran's nuclear program are resuming in Geneva, though representatives on both sides say a number of significant issues remain unresolved. Iran's being offered limited sanctions relief in return for agreeing to curtail uranium enrichment work. There have been further demonstrations in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, after revelations that the country's government was targeted by an Australian spying operation. Indonesia's president's halted military and other diplomatic cooperation with Australia, demanding an explanation of the surveillance work. And today is the final day of global talks on climate change in Poland, but environmental campaigners at the negotiations say they've become a mockery. Around 800 of them walked out of talks yesterday, saying there was little evidence of any commitment to agree a binding deal to cut greenhouse gas emissions. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul Osborne. We'll see you again at the top of the hour for more headlines. It's 10:32 in Cairo, 8:32 here in London, 3:32 in Bogota. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24. And it's time now to conclude our week-long series on soft power around the world. During the past week, we've taken a look at soft power superstars to coincide with Monocle's annual soft power survey. Nations are increasingly trying to get what they want through attraction rather than coercion, looking beyond military might to exert a more nuanced influence on the world stage. And one of the best means of garnering global attention is through well-known figures, national brands, or indeed national trends.
Well, today we head to Colombia, where the country's investment in cycling is about more than winning, but changing perceptions. A short while ago, Monocle's Barbara Feeney spoke to Anastasia Maloney, our correspondent in the Colombian capital, Bogota. Barbara began by asking about the popularity of cycling in Colombia.
Cycling has always been really popular in Colombia. In fact, I'd say it's probably the second most popular sport after football. A lot of that has to do with the Colombian riders of the 1980s. They became household names in and outside of Colombia. Cycling fans will remember Lucho Herrera and Fabio Parra, and they had great victories in the big races in Europe during the 1980s. And it was from them, basically, that Colombians began to look at their cyclists as heroes and the people who kind of triumphed in Europe. And it was from then that Colombian cycling became well-known and popular in the country.
And was there a slight lull in the period that cycling was popular in the 80s, because it has been revived in the past couple of years?
That's right. There was a lull after those big victories by Herrera and Parra. And it has come back. There's been a renaissance. And more than 20 years later, and leading this renaissance is the Colombia's 472 team. That stands for the latitude and longitude of Colombia. And they're the riders, the next generation of riders that we're seeing now win in Europe. And probably the best known rider is a Colombian called Nairo Quintana. And he actually spent a bit of time training with the 472 team. And Nairo Quintana has become very famous because he came second in this year's Tour de France at the highest ever finished by a Colombian cyclist.
Impresionante, tranquila Goga, 3:38, está por llegar Quintana. Quintana.
I was talking with the racing director, 472, Luis Fernando Rios, and she's telling me that their aim now is to really have a Colombian team made up of 100% Colombian riders compete and win in Europe.
Nuestro objetivo final es tener un equipo de 100%.
Our final objective is to have a 100% Colombian team competing in the three great races, whether it's the Tour of Spain, Tour of Italy, and Tour de France. And we're doing it. We've been developing the talent of our new group of riders who are going to be representing Colombia. We're going to achieve our goal. Our goal in 2016 will be racing in one of those three great races with 100% Colombian riders. The difference in the 1980s when Lucho Herrera and Fabio Parra raced is that there were great riders of other nationalities in the team. We want to change history and to have 100% Colombian riders up on the podium. I think Nairo Quintana has shown us the way and that it's totally viable.
Why have we seen this revival of cycling in Colombia?
It's actually to do with a government policy that arose in 2002 during the previous government of Álvaro Uribe. And what that president was looking for, he really wanted to change the image of Colombia. Colombia has still quite a negative image abroad. It's associated with drug trafficking, big cocaine cartels, and a guerrilla insurgency. And the president was very keen to try and change that image by using sport, and in this case, cycling. And he thought that cycling could be part of the policy of soft diplomacy. And it actually arose through a study that he commissioned to see what people abroad thought about Colombia, the positive aspects, particularly in sport. And it turned out that people abroad thought that cycling was the most positive sport that had come out of Colombia.
A study was carried out in the US and Europe to see what Colombian sport had a positive connotation in the world. And the conclusion was cycling. So that's when it was decided to create the 472 cycling team. Our role is very much based on being ambassadors of our country. We're leading an example to show we can change our negative image. It's about telling the world that Colombia is not just about the negative things that everyone knows about, like drug trafficking and kidnapping, but that in Colombia, they're capable and professional people with ethics who love their country.
Has cycling been an effective method of changing how people look at Colombia?
I think without a doubt, you definitely do see the headlines now that there are Colombian riders winning in Europe. And that has, particularly in the Tour de France with Nairo Quintana, that has definitely changed the headlines about Colombia. But when I spoke to Luisa, she said that at the beginning, when the team went to Europe to compete in the big cycling races there in 2006, it was actually very difficult for people to respect the Colombian team because of the stereotypes and the prejudices they had about Colombia.
At the beginning, when we first traveled to Europe in 2006, when the team was set up, it was difficult to clear the way for a Colombian cycling team. People had prejudices about Colombians and Colombia, like cocaine and all those negative things. But over the past 4 years, we've noticed a change. Now Colombia, in cycling terms, is respected. Those of our riders who form part of international teams are respected. Our great cycling ambassadors like Quintana, Henao, and Rigoberto have all helped a lot to change the image of Colombians all around the world.
The other particular thing about cycling in Colombia is that it's mainly a sport of the poor. A lot of parents who buy their children bicycles actually do it because they believe it's almost an antidote to violence. It's going to keep them off the street, keep them away from gangs, and keep them away from violence. And the rider I was speaking to, Juan Pablo, he came from a very poor rural community. He used to help his parents grow coffee. And that's quite a common story that these cyclists have. Also, Nairo Quintana came from a very poor family in Andean hilltop village. But they all have one dream, and that's to race in Europe and be part of the best races there, particularly at the Tour de France.
En el día de la fiesta nacional de Colombia.
Felicidades, Colombia! Felicidades, Oscar!
That was Anastasia Maloney, Monocle's correspondent in Bogota, speaking to Barbara Feeney a short while ago. And don't forget, the latest edition of Monocle magazine includes our annual Soft Power Survey. We take a look at 30 countries who best attract favour from other nations through their culture, sport, cuisine, design, diplomacy and beyond. They're on newsstands near you now.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with celebrated author Joseph Boyden to talk about his new novel, The Urenda.
Whether it's the latest Broadway musical, that book which no one can put down, or the music track destined to rule the Nordic charts, we'll be sure to have an opinion about it on The Review. Every Saturday, we digest, debate, and critique the latest music, films, books, theatre, TV, and art, bringing you personal points of view, lively discussion, and laughter.
It's absolutely amazing to think that this was all done by one man in one year.
This is the time of year when everything is about Broadway, Broadway, Broadway. What wins, what loses, what runs, what closes.
I have always had the same response. You know, I didn't realize I was going to enjoy that so much.
It's a slow boiler. I mean, it is kind of in the tradition of The Killing, really, and there's always the inevitable comparisons, you know, at the moment with these sort of crime dramas, but it is in that vein.
I think with Robert Capa, it definitely is photojournalism. He died on the front lines. He never lived long enough to see his photography become artwork as we see it today, as a collectible item.
So whether you're spending the weekend in Europe, gearing up for a night out in Asia, or planning a bit of culture for the week ahead in the Americas, tune in to The Review, live every Saturday at midday London time and repeated across the weekend right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:41 here in London. The Urenda is the new novel from Canadian author Joseph Boyden, who previously won Canada's most prestigious literary award, the Scotiabank Giller Prize, in 2008. The book is an epic set in the 17th century North America, often brutal, that tells the story of young Snowfalls, who is kidnapped by Bird, one of the Huron Nation's great warrior and statesman.
Well, to tell us more about his book, which one critic has described as one of the most powerful novels he's ever read, and the National Post described as not just a timely novel, but a timeless one, born a classic, we are delighted to welcome Joseph Boyden to the Monocle 24 studio this morning. Thanks very much indeed for joining us, and congratulations on the extraordinary acclaim that your book's already received. You're a descendant yourself of Canada's First Nations. How did your own family history inform your decision to write this story?
This novel, I think, is, I've been saying, it's almost a part of my DNA. It's a book I waited to write until my age now. I wrote two before this. My family's a mixed blood family.
You should stress that you're still quite young.
I'm relatively, I guess, for a writer. My family's a mixed blood family of Irish, Scottish, and Ojibwe roots, and I pulled from both sides of my heritage to create this novel, the European as well as the First Nations or the Indian side of my bloodlines.
Some critics say this is quite a brutal novel with exploring very tragic roots. What are some of the problems facing First Nations people in Canada?
Well, yeah, you know, to address the first thing, it's certainly a brutal novel. In many ways, it was a brutal time. That's not to say First Nations people are a brutal people by any means. This is a novel about family as much as anything. But, you know, any good historical novel will somehow resonate contemporarily. And I think this novel does. You know, First Nations people in Canada are facing an uphill battle in so many ways. They've been put in a position over the last 150 years of having to fend for themselves. You know, this novel tries to address historically what's happening contemporarily.
You do a lot of work yourself with at-risk youth and have been campaigning for their rights. It's obviously something that's very close to your heart.
Yeah. For sure. I'm working oftentimes in Northern Ontario, Northern Canada, the reservations called reserves. Suicide rates are often 100 times higher than the rest of Canada, the rest of the world. It's often these reserves are called the suicide capitals of the world. It's a very personal thing for me. So I get up to reserves and work with youth, getting them back out on the land and teaching them as much as I can and my friends can, traditional ways of life to try to connect them back to what they've lost in the past.
There's been great acclaim about the novel, but one critic also said it made for very uncomfortable reading. Why do you think that is? Do you think the truth is uncomfortable? History is uncomfortable?
Absolutely. You know, I didn't want to paint this kind of idyllic picture. You know, in North America, before the arrival of the Europeans, there were societies that are incredibly culturally rich societies, religiously, socially, and they were in a fine balance with one another. And it was not a paradise in North America before the arrival of the Europeans, but certainly there were many societies in a fine balance with one another. And when the Europeans came in the 1600s to Canada and to the United States, what are now Canada and the United States, this kind of balance was thrown off. And, you know, it's a really rich time to explore, and I was really, you know, excited to go back and go in depth about a period in history that so few people know about.
Joseph, it's a real tome. You've obviously put a huge amount of work into it. I know, very readable too, but it does run to almost 500 pages.
Yeah.
Obviously you said it's part of your DNA. It's been a long time coming. Did it take you a long time to research and write?
It did. You know, there's many different types of research to do with a novel with it like this. You know, there's the obvious kind of Western research of reading a lot, but there's also the research of going to the people, going to the elders and speaking to them about this territory. You have to be very respectful when you go to another person's place. My family, being Ojibwe, this story is about the Huron and the Iroquois, and so they're not my peoples. And so I went to the experts, I went to the elders, Georges Siwi, for example, who's a Huron elder. I went to him and spoke to him and said, you know, I need permission. I need your permission. You're okay for me to feel comfortable. You know, the first 50 pages took me 2.5 years to write. And the last 450 poured out of me in about 14 months. And so it's this really kind of strange balance.
And would you say that this is a book that every Canadian should read as part of their history? And not only that, because it's probably relevant to today as well with the rise and fall of nations.
I would love if every Canadian read this book. but, you know, this is a book that it came from a part of me that is bigger than me in so many ways. This is a book that I do hope more than just Canadians read. And it's not only for my ego to be satisfied by other people reading it, but to understand where a large group of Canadians came from and are today.
Tell us, Joseph, quickly about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and how that helps to foreground some of the issues faced by the First Nations people today.
Oh, I could speak for hours about that. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission is a put together by between the Assembly of First Nations, the Canadian government, and Native people in Canada. It's inspired and started by what happened in Canada. There was something called residential schools for about 120 years where First Nations people weren't forced to give up their children and put into schools. And over the course of this 120 years, the idea was to take the Indian out of the Indian, to make the Indian person into a proper white part of society. Obviously, it really backward thinking. And these schools didn't even close. You know, the last ones closed in the early 1990s in Canada. And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is trying to come to terms with the huge abuse that went on, physical, emotional, and especially sexual abuse that happened in so many of these schools, and try to come to terms with our history. And so, you know, this is such a complicated thing, but it's been going on for 5 years now, and
with mixed results.
Results, the Canadian government is not giving up all of its all of the papers. It's not sharing everything it should. So it's really, you know, but the whole objective is healing, is the, you know, the beginning of healing. It's going to take a long time for First Nations in Canada to feel like we are part of the country. And you have to keep in mind too, First Nations in Canada, it's the fastest growing population in our country, and so, you know, the Native people are not going anywhere, it's high time, I think, for us to address many of these issues.
And just briefly, for anyone reading the book, what would you like them to take away from it?
You know, there's a lot of talk about the violence of this novel, and my greatest fear is that people walk away from this novel fearing that, or thinking that First Nations people are a violent group. It, you know, this is a novel of violence, but it's not about a particular group. You know, I hope that people walk away saying this is a novel about family and love as much as anything else.
Dare we ask what you're going to do next? It feels like this is such a huge thing for you.
I need to rest for a while. I'm actually working on a television show for CBC in Canada, and I'm also working on a young adult novel, actually, that I'm really excited about. So
we look forward to speaking to you again then.
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much indeed, Joseph Boyd, and winner of the Canada's most prestigious literary prize, the Scotiabank Giller Prize. Thank you for joining us here on Midori House to discuss your latest novel, The Arenda.
Thank you. It is
out now.
Well, before we leaf through the day's newspapers, it's time for a little music. This is Lisa Hannigan with What I'll Do.
What'll I do without you around when my words won't come? Without you.
Lisa Hannigan with What I'll Do.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Victoria Graham, and Clemency Burton Hill. Time now to leaf through the day's European front pages with Barbara Feeney. Barbara, what do you have for us first today?
Good morning, Victoria. So, this morning I'm going to start talking about these three women who were freed from a house in South London. They were held captive for 30 years, it's believed.
Really shocking story, this one, isn't it? You think it just happened down the road.
Yeah, really shocking, at our doorsteps. So we're looking to the Irish Times for... So the woman who actually, you know, who brought this story to light, she was the Irish woman. She watched this documentary on ITV, and she became inspired to ring this helpline. And then the police found out about it, and they came and they stormed the house, and they found these three women who were held captive for 30 years. So it's quite a shocking story that this slavery is, you know, happening at our doorsteps. And it was just happening in South London. So, you know, it's...
And amazing that a call like that can lead to freedom for these other women. I mean, it seems like a really important moment, and thank God she made the call.
I know. And what's quite interesting is that in the Irish Times today, Mark Hennessy writes that, you know, slavery is actually it's misunderstood. We don't necessarily, you know what slavery means, especially in a country like the UK. It's life-changing. And, you know, people are kind of trapped.
And we don't know what really prompted her to make the call either, just that she did.
Yeah.
She saw the freedom, didn't it? It was the charity Freedom and the woman on that. And I guess she saw this woman and thought, right, I've got to make a move now. But after 30 years, such a long time. I mean, you imagine slavery as being someone chained up, don't you? And you can't get out. But in actual fact, I think they were allowed movement.
Exactly.
But they never know if they're being threatened or not.
They had limited movement. And that is what they're saying in this article today, that often our depiction of slavery is someone who's chained in a house. But these women actually had limited freedom. They were allowed out, and we did find out in a number of articles that they were moving around. They were allowed to watch television, and so that's what prompted their call to call the police.
And
so
what's perhaps most shocking is that kind of slavery, there could be people running into their thousands who
are
subjected.
And that is what some detectives from Scotland Yard are now saying, that they fear that there is, you know, other cases like this. And this is one of the most shocking cases that they've ever seen in the UK. And there was similar cases with the Irish travelling community who held some homeless men as slaves, and that just happened only last year. And this also brings to light the story on May earlier this year of the three women who were held captive in a house in Ohio.
by their school bus driver.
Let's move over to a completely different story now, but one that's just as interesting, particularly for Irish audiences, and no doubt those on the other side of the pond too. It is, of course, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of JFK.
It is indeed. So, Clemency, looking to the International New York Times, there is quite a bit of coverage about JFK's the 50th anniversary of his death, which is today. And there's also a lot of coverage in the Irish Times. As you can see here on the front of the Irish Times, there is a picture of JFK, and he was quite a, you know, dear to Irish people. And if we see here, there is an extract from the newspaper, and it says that Kennedy's death created, you know, it was really dear in the hearts, and it was a lot of trauma for Irish people. But there's also quite a, they talk about the shame in Dallas in Texas, because there's a huge business being made out of the assassination, and people aren't very happy about that. So that is also an interesting thing. But what I found, which was most interesting, was in the International New York Times, that the commemoration of the death, he was such a figure in the US, but it's also kind of obscuring the actual message. So in America, in the International New York Times, they're saying that America is divided, and it's a dangerous place. And this message, you know, is being obscured by what happened in the anniversary that is.
And I understand that many people in Dallas are hoping that this 50th anniversary could actually be one of the last, because they want to sort of like push it aside now, because they don't want to be known for this anniversary for the rest of their time.
Yes, exactly.
Good luck with that. Yes. The way that we like to commemorate
these
things.
You can never erase history, can you?
Let's very, very quickly, Barbara, talk about the Tube's 24-hour opening signal, signalling the end of the ticket offices.
Yes. So, Clemency, they are hoping to run the Tube for 24 hours a day in 2015. So that's going to make a lot of Tube staff redundant, because the ticket offices are going to be left empty because of new ticketing systems. But Amazon are hoping to use these spaces as drop-off points. So it's an interesting business move by Amazon. So we'll have to wait and see what happens.
What a surprise. Amazon jumping in there, seeing a perfect business opportunity. Barbara Feeney, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning. Sadly, that's all we have time for today. Thanks very much to our producer, Thomas Lewis, our researcher, Barbara, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Up next after the news, it's this week's edition of Section D with Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday. But for now, from me, Clemency Burtonhill.
And me, Victoria Graham. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.